Hey, good morning, everybody. My name is Karen Von Hippel. I'm the co-director here of the PCR project, along with Rick Barton, who many of you know, and he'll be here in a few minutes. It's my pleasure today to welcome Chris Fair and Shumit Ganguly to talk about their new book. It's a pleasure not only because, you know, we're very excited about the book, but Chris has been a great friend of the project. She's been super helpful with us and a very positive influence on our work on Pakistan and Afghanistan. And so we consider her a close friend of the PCR project, and it's a pleasure to meet Shumit for the first time today. We've also been working on the role of religion in conflict settings for several years now, and so this book is a very timely look at a very critical aspect of how we deal with sacred places when we go into conflict zones, how our soldiers and civilians understand or don't understand the role of religion in a number of these places. So this book also dovetails very nicely with our ongoing work that will be continuing for the next year, which is funded by the Luce Foundation. Everything is going to be recorded today, so it's available for podcast. So if you want to hear any of their wise words later, you can always go back and hit reverse and hit replay again. And it should be available tonight, right? Yeah. So as soon as possible, we'll put it on our website, which is pcrproject.com, or the CSIS website. You can go to either place. So I've asked both speakers to speak for about 10 to 15 minutes. I'll just briefly mention a few points about each of them. They're both South Asia experts. Shumit is at Indiana University, and he is the president. He's a professor of political science and director of research for the Center on American and Global Security. I lost my other one. He's written a dozen books on South Asia, so he's a real expert. He's worked at several very important universities on the subject over the years, and so it'll be really fascinating to hear his take. Chris, I think most of you know, is at the RAND Corporation, but she's also a scholar practitioner. She spent time in the field working for UNAMA in Afghanistan. She's also worked at USIP, so she has a very rich bio as well, and so we're really looking forward to your comments. So, Shumit, please let me pass the floor to you.
Thanks very much, and I'm particularly grateful to you and to CSIS for hosting this event. To begin with, I should really thank my partner in crime, Chris Fair, because it was really at her initiative that this entire project got started. I believe 2 years ago at the International Studies Association, where Chris organized a panel. There were more people on the panel than in the room, but this is fairly typical of present-day political science, where anything that has to do with any policy relevance is immediately shunned by all our colleagues. Fortunately, I have tenure, so I can say things like this. But Chris really shepherded this project from the very outset, and from that we successfully managed to approach Oxford University Press, and lo and behold, we actually have a book now. We added several chapters, and speaking of chapters, I'll just provide a kind of a tour d'horizon of the book. We have a substantial number of cases, which includes the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. It includes the Kaaba case from Saudi Arabia, two cases from the Punjab, which Chris writes about. I have two cases from Kashmir, one involving a mosque, the other involving a shrine, and it's almost sort of a perfect social science experiment, about as close as we can get in real life to a social science experiment on the Kashmir case, which I will talk about somewhat greater length, because in one case you have almost complete success. In fact, you have complete success, and in the other case, it's the case history of a failure, of a utter unimaginable disaster. In addition to this, we have a case on the Krusei Mosque in southern Thailand, which was also a completely botched counterinsurgency operation. It's again the case history of another mistake.
Red Mosque.
And of course, which was added on at the very last moment in haste. And it's jointly written with one of my graduate students, Chris, and one of my graduate students, Panjit Pardesi, wrote the chapter on the Red Mosque in Islamabad. That constitutes the array of cases. Let me talk a little bit about the significance of the book and about the substance of the book. Why are sacred places so attractive to insurgents, regardless of religious orientation and regardless of location? There are four themes that I've been able to sort of distill from the discussions that both Ron Hassner and Nora Ben-Sahel provide, which bookend the various chapters. Most importantly, there are four themes that I'm going to dwell upon. The most important one, obviously, is that they provide sanctuaries. Militaries, police forces, paramilitary forces are exceedingly reluctant to enter sanctuaries, particularly sanctuaries which have a religious sanction for fear of offending large populations. And almost invariably, the insurgents belong to the particular religious group within which this particular institution is embedded, whether it's a mosque, whether it's a temple, whether it's a synagogue. It casts a particular aura on the insurgents, and here there is a very interesting contradiction, because a sacred place really should not be a place for violence or the refuge of people in engaging in violence. And if I may sort of poach on your territory a little bit, Chris, the contradiction was particularly evident in the Golden Temple. Because in the Golden Temple, after the assault on the Golden Temple in 1984, significant segments of the Sikh community, including for the first time in India's independent history, there was a mutiny of fairly small proportions, but nevertheless there was a mutiny within the Indian Army amongst certain Sikh regiments. But the contradiction was never faced up to by the community. Here you had people who were insurgents who were completely violating the norms and the principles of the Golden Temple. And yet, when the Indian military flushed out the insurgents, because they did considerable damage to the edifice, all the opprobrium was attached to the military and none of it to the insurgents. But this is hardly unique to the Indian case, to the Golden Temple case. This has happened elsewhere. But I mentioned the Golden Temple because both of us are particularly familiar with that particular operation. So the first point is that it provides a sanctuary for insurgents, and a sanctuary which is in some senses almost impregnable. It is with great trepidation that military forces, and only as a last resort, will attack a sanctuary when all other attempts of drawing the insurgents out have failed. Second, and related to the sacredness of these sanctuaries, I'm going to use a particular term which a very famous political scientist, a man called Murray Edelman from the University of Wisconsin, who wrote a very important book on symbolic politics. The book is called The Symbolic Uses of Politics. What Edelman talked about is a term that he coined. It's called dramaturgy. Dramaturgy refers to the kind of drama that you can bring about by forcing the security forces to attack you, because it immediately then generates sort of this notion of a siege, and the siege of a sacred place, of being beleaguered, of a community being under attack. Even though all manner of execrable acts might have been committed by using that sanctuary as a base, but that's quickly forgotten. Instead, the drama of the siege becomes of enormous symbolic importance and then assumes a life of its own afterwards, particularly if the operation is botched and if there are high casualties, and especially if there are civilian casualties and if pilgrims are killed in the process, as happened in the Golden Temple. The third, of course, is related to the first two themes, namely raising support. often it will generate enormous support, particularly amongst the hardcore followers of the movement, the people who are passionately committed to the movement. This will generate enormous support, especially if the operation is not successful, if the use of force is not minimized, if the use of force is not highly calibrated, if any damage is done to sacred artifacts. Then, of course, these stories will be adumbrated upon, these stories will be dwelt upon, they will be embroidered. And of course, today with modern media, all manner of conspiracy theories will then flow out from any particular episode. And here, of course, my postmodernist colleagues would have a field day, because multiple narratives will be constructed, as they are fond of pointing out. That there is no truth, there is no there. These are only narratives. And of course, multiple narratives will promptly emerge, and thereby generating support, not just amongst the people already committed to the movement, but even the fence sitters. Many of them will now be inclined to join the movement because of all manner of lurid tales that will emerge from this failed operation. Finally, and again, these are all related themes, you also want to raise the costs to the counterinsurgent forces, to raise the costs of carrying out similar operations in the future. So you may booby trap certain portions of a temple or a mosque or a synagogue or a shrine, and then pin the blame on the counterinsurgent forces. You turn the tables on the counterinsurgent forces, even though you may have put IEDs in strategic points of entry, which then detonate at particular moments, causing considerable damage to sacred edifices. But the onus then is shifted very deftly. As you can see, all of these things are closely related, but they also form then sort of the corpus of this particular problem, and they underscore why counterinsurgency operations in sacred places are such fraught enterprises. Let me stop here. Turn this over to Chris.
Okay, thank you very much. I just want to make a quick comment. I'm very impressed. You can tell he's a professor. He's got 5 words on his entire paper, so and he's so extremely articulate. So thank you very much for that, Chris.
Thank you. That's great.
Well, also, I want to thank Karen for putting this together. And also, you know, it's a pleasure working with Shumit. I mean, we've all gotten sucked into these book projects, and the book never materializes. This never happens with Shumit. He has this uncanny ability to corral people and make them deliver. We had one very recalcitrant author who I won't name, but Shumit was just very good without using a taser to get all the manuscripts in.
So
tempted. Yes, he was. So I'm actually going to try to draw out some of the lessons that came from the various cases that we looked at in this volume. And to be clear, some of the cases I know better than others. Perhaps in the Q&A we could talk about the Punjab insurgency, Operation Blue Star and Operation Black Thunder. And as he noted, although Manjeet Pardesi is the author, you know, I obviously worked with him quite a bit on the Red Mosque. Some of the other cases, you know, I don't know so terribly well. Like the Iraq case is not one that I understand all that clearly. But when there are a number of areas that really are advantageous for insurgents to use these spaces from a very realistic and operational point of view. The first is from a recruitment aspect. Use of these spaces confer religious or sacred facade to violent struggles. And if you look at all of the cases in our volume, this was certainly the case. In many cases, the insurgents are able to weave their current struggle into the past history of their religious community's historiography or biographies of previous martial leaders. And I did, as I said, the Sikh case, and the Sikhs have a very strong martial history. And if you were to go to any Gurdwara, that supported the Khalistan insurgency, you would see Bindranwale, who was the lead insurgent, you know, at the end of a number of Sikh martyrs. And in different ways and to different degrees, all of the cases really demonstrated the ability to weave the current struggle into the past struggle. And this was important because it gave a sense of legitimacy to the conflict that may not have really existed in their community of supporters before their ability to do that. At the larger sites, and you really saw this at the Golden Temple, at the Red Mosque in Islamabad, the cases that Shumit looks at, you have this constant influx of worshipers coming into the site. And this was actually a fantastic opportunity to recruiters to go and meet potential activists for the movement. Once you have this notoriety that you have militants ensconced in a particular shrine, it becomes an issue of supply and demand. So individuals that want to take part in the movement know that they can go to the shrine and meet recruiters. And so it sort of lowers the cost of recruitment because it's sort of one-stop shopping, both for the recruiter and for the people that want to become a part of the movement. Another thing that really comes out in many but not all of the cases is the value of religious entrepreneurs. And this could be any number of things. It could be politicians who share the religious faith. Like, for example, in the Red Mosque, we're looking at the Deobandis and their political allies in the JUI. In the Sikh case, there were always a number of Sikh political parties. And in addition to that, you actually have religious scholars, you know, the ulama, Sikh grunthis, and all the cases have their own equivalent. And those characters are actually very interesting. The first thing is that the insurgents understand how important they are. They actually, because the insurgents know that they're fighting an insurgency long before the state, in many cases, know they're in an insurgency, target those religious entrepreneurs. They either co-opt them through violence or through threat of violence, or that they actually persuade the religious entrepreneur to the side of the insurgents. Many times these folks issue religious edicts justifying what they're doing. I remember when I was working with UNAMA, this is sort of off topic, but I think the point remains, in Kandahar, there was a religious shura that basically issued a fatwa against suicide bombing. Now, you may think prima facie that was a great thing, but then the Taliban began assassinating each and every single one of those signatories, and that certainly made a strong message to future would-be fatwa issuers that suicide bombing is a bad idea. So it was interesting, by the time the state, in many of our cases, realized that these guys were important assets to be protected, they had already been compromised. And, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, but there's not much you can do about it, but we know that those individuals are very important. Often the physical layout of the shrines themselves offer a number of advantages. We saw this with the Golden Temple. We saw this with the Grand Mosque, minarets, underground facilities. The insurgents are able to use the entire expanse of the facility to their advantage. And what's really quite curious, while many of these spaces are actually open, so you would think that military intelligence or police could actually observe what the militants are up to, in virtually every case, they abjectly failed to take advantage of the openness to monitor things. So in point of fact, the openness of the shrine almost always redounded to the insurgents' advantages. The other interesting thing about these shrines is that they really became a logistical hub. In almost all of the cases, the militants could ensconce there because they have rest houses. Many of the religious traditions that are in our book actually have, I guess, public kitchens would be the best way to describe them. Obviously, they have phone and fax facilities. Just about every amenity that a militant or an insurgent organization could possibly want are in these shrines. So you can imagine that this is a tremendous opportunity for militants to ensconce themselves there. Of course, the second aspect is that they actually diminish the chance of the state directly engaging the militants once they're in there. And in some of the insurgents, they actually fled to the insurgent or fled to the sacred space with full knowledge that going there would provide them some sort of immunity. Shumit noted sometimes this is due to right of sanctuary. Sometimes it's because the shrines are international heritage sites or they are national heritage sites. In the case of India, they had such a problem with the police and the military personnel entering these shrines that they actually had to pass a law making it illegal for individuals to appropriate these religious sites for nefarious purposes, anti-state purposes. And that actually gave the counterinsurgency forces the legitimate cover to enter. And that was actually, when you look at the way India has managed a number of its insurgencies, it's actually used its parliamentary arm of government to really make a lot of space. In some cases, it wasn't always so good, but in this case, that particular law was an important aspect of their ability to deal with counterinsurgency, particularly during the Punjab insurgency. The other thing that's sort of interesting, Shamit talked about the way in which in the Punjab insurgency, Operation Blue Star in particular, undermined command and control of the counterinsurgency forces. But this wasn't only occurring in the Indian case. For those of you who know about the Saudi case, both the Saudi army and the National Guards demanded fatwas. And even when fatwas were issued, about one-third of the 3,004 simply refused to conduct the operation. And in fact, many of them actively sided with the insurgents. In the case of the Red Mosque, now the current situation of the Pakistan Army is very complicated. I wouldn't want to say that some of the morale issues that have debilitated the Pakistan Army and has made some of their commitment to coin, I don't want to put all of that on the Red Mosque. But certainly the Red Mosque galvanized a wider insurgency. Much of what happened in Swat was a reaction to the Red Mosque. And this was certainly part of a series of events that have really caused a number of morale issues within the Pakistan Army. A third aspect of ensconcing a militant movement in these facilities is that they really target symbols of state authority very directly. In almost every single one of the cases, the shrines were important either for cultural, political, religious, obviously, or historical reasons. Amritsar had always been a place, a ground zero, if you will, for political activity. So has Srinagar. Obviously, the Grand Mosque, nothing targets the center of Saudi authority like targeting the Grand Mosque. And, you know, it really redounds to the militants' advantages. They don't have to win. They simply have to keep the state from being able to exert control. So they have a very different definition of what it means to win than the state does. So in short, when you look across the cases, what you find is that sacred space intensifies all of the demands that you would expect in a counterinsurgency campaign. All counterinsurgency requires good intelligence, but when you do it on sacred space, you need to have even better intelligence, and you have to be able to anticipate intelligence that wouldn't ordinarily be part of an assessment of the battlefield. You have to think about religious authorities as an asset in all parts of planning. Often folks don't realize how important the particular shrine is or how the operation will play out because they really haven't figured out who they need to engage. Or worse yet, the individuals that they need to engage have already been co-opted, or if they haven't been co-opted, the state fails to protect them. So these are really important assets in a counterinsurgency campaign on sacred space that is rarely really, I think, thought through adequately. Interestingly enough, you also have to have particular security for the counterinsurgent forces themselves. Now, think about this. We saw this with the Golden Temple. There are six in the army. There are six in the police forces. And, you know, they also want to go to temples to worship. Now, by the time the state already finds itself in a position where it has to fight these guys, the insurgents already know who the counterinsurgents are, and they began targeting them. So you actually, not only do you have to think about the battle space, you also have to really think about the fact that in some cases, the insurgents have already identified who the counterinsurgents are and have begun doing things that diminish their will to fight. Public perceptions. I mean, Shamit talked about this a lot. I was really struck when I looked at the contrast between Operation Blue Star, which was an army operation conducted disastrously at night. The Indians then had no night vision capability, in a complete media blackout under curfew. The militants actually had complete information operations dominance because the state had no assets in play to shape the way in which the public received information about the operation. In fact, the militants understood this. And Bindranwale had pre-positioned cassettes. Remember, this is the 80s, so it's cassette culture. You know, now it would probably be DVDs or viral videos or something taken on a cell phone. So the militants had actually already pre-positioned information assets to shape the way in which the fellow religionists would understand the operation. In contrast, when they did Operation Black Thunder, They did it under a complete media umbrella. Everyone could actually see what was going on. It was done in broad daylight. It wasn't an army operation. It was a siege operation. And whereas Operation Blue Star really precipitated not only a more intense insurgency in the Punjab, but it actually accumulated a lot of anti-Indian activity in the Sikh diaspora that was inclusive of raising money, raising weapons, and raising persons to go and fight, Operation Black Thunder in some ways laid the foundation for an information campaign that began to undermine the movement because people could see in a very direct way the predatory behavior of the insurgents that were ensconced there. Restraint of force really comes across in our cases. Now, truth in advertising, most of our cases are failures. We don't have very, it's amazing, even India and Pakistan, they're right next to each other. The Pakistanis didn't seem to learn a darn thing from the Indians' operations, either in Kashmir or in the Punjab. But the cases that seem to be most successful really seem to be those that use restraint, and in particular, sieges. Ron Hasner talks about the Church of the Nativity. That was a siege operation. Operation Black Thunder, that was a siege operation. And those actually seem to work best for all the reasons that Shamit identified. We also looked at the peculiar role of foreigners. Foreigners, either if they are the counterinsurgents or if they are the insurgents, is bad news because foreigners often don't know how to read the situation, and you know that's very well known. But when we looked at the presence of foreigners as insurgents, they are also bad news. And the reason is that they have no attachment to the local community, and in many cases they don't share the exact confessional faith as the shrine in which they're ensconced. So, for example, the Salafists or the Deobandis ensconced in a Sufi shrine in Kashmir, they actually think those guys are apostates. So they really don't care if they blow up that particular shrine because they have no attachment to it. And they are fairly confident that the state will be responsible for the destruction of the shrine, even if it's initiated by the foreigners. So foreigners are, this is certainly an element that operational planners have to be aware of because those guys are loose cannons. They don't share the same commitment as the neighborhood in which they are ensconced. So I think I'll end there for the Q&A.
Great. Well, that was really super. And I think, thank you both. And I think I'm going to abuse my position as a chair and press you both a little bit further on another type of foreigner on the international community. Given that the media and insurgents are typically codependent, you know, they need each other, how do you see, how good is the analysis by the international media? How good is the analysis by our diplomats and others that are monitoring these events? And, you know, given that there's so many competing narratives, how good are they at disentangling these narratives? And if they're as bad as we probably think they are, how can that be improved? Do you have any recommendations in your book or no?
Do you want to go first?
Actually, the analyses vary enormously. The ones that come out almost immediately in the wake of a particular incident are short on facts, are written hastily, are often reliant upon one side or the other. It's only when you have a bit of distance. For example, on the Golden Temple, we know a great deal because two very intrepid journalists, both from the BBC, one was the BBC's principal correspondent and the second was a stringer, Mark Tully and Satish Jacob, who provide not only a detailed account of what transpired, but also contextualize the case. Whereas, for example, on the case of the Grand Mosque, our knowledge is still extremely fragmentary because of the nature of the Saudi state and because of the extraordinary significance that's attached to the mosque. It's still shrouded, you know, I'm tempted to use Churchill's description of the Soviet Union about an enigma surrounded in a mystery, and so we have this French anthropologist who wrote this, and of course deciphering his prose was sort of like, was like a Sherlock Holmes mystery in itself, and Chris deserves much credit for transforming it into idiomatic English. It's actually one of the best chapters on that particular episode because he knows Arabic, he's traveled and done extensive field work in Saudi Arabia. So in the long-winded answer to your question is that it depends. On some cases, we still have very fragmentary evidence and conflicting accounts, unsettled scenarios of what really transpired. And this was a huge problem for us in drafting this book.
I have a few additional thoughts in addition to what Shumit just laid out. One, I think the vernacular press is really important. We are poorly equipped to deal with the English elite press in many of the countries in which we operate. We are absolutely incapable of dealing with the vernacular press. And, I mean, I don't care what aspect of our engagement with countries we pick. We can look at this topic or any other topic. But the vernacular press is really important. I think it's also important that, yes, it's true, and I know this from UNAMA, because, you know, when we would have a civilian casualty event, UNAMA would dispatch its human rights investigators down, and they would come up with the correct figures. The Taliban said they were all civilians, and of course, you know, that's not always the case. But by the time that story gets out, it is absolutely irrelevant, because what seems to matter is the first narrative out of the chute. And what I really like about the Operation Black Thunder case was that those folks, they'd learned their lesson from Blue Star. They had the media there from the get-go. They understood that what was going to matter and what would stick is the first story. And it didn't matter necessarily that maybe the first story didn't get it right, but you had a multiplicity of first stories that were competing. And I think of all of the cases that we looked at, KPS Gill or whoever the real plan, there's some controversy among a number of gentlemen who take responsibility for the planning. But whoever in the end put this together really understood that you've got to have the media there from the get-go. And we have this problem in Fatah. I mean, this is the same problem. Once a target's hit, there are no media assets in Fatah. So whether they killed all civilians and poor, you know, women and children, or whether they were all al-Qaeda bad guys, there's no one there. So we lose the IO initiative really as soon as the bomb gets dropped. So I think thinking about having a vernacular press strategy, and, you know, this is true not just for COIN. I think this is true for how we ought to be engaging certain countries. We should know, we should have a strategic list of who are the information shapers in a given country, in a given language. We should have a short list, you know, who's the Urdu guy? And we should just know this. I mean, our folks at the embassy should have this. And they should be managed as an asset. They should be engaged. They should be on the scene when this stuff goes down. To keep harping on the religious entrepreneurs, condition on having to engage in either direct or indirect action. Religious entrepreneurs have to be part of the engagement strategy from the get-go, because they're the ones who can say, in the case of the Sikh temple, well, actually the insurgents were ensconced above the sacred text, which is absolutely apostasy in the Sikh faith. That they were, in fact, the ones that were committing egregious crimes against the Sikh community. Religious entrepreneurs really have to be a part of this. And you kind of, it's almost impossible, because only ex ante do you know that they're important. So when you think about this kind of battle space, you really have to think ahead, who are my assets? And then you really have to protect them, because the insurgents go after these religious entrepreneurs. They're the first to get targeted. And we've seen this in Afghanistan. We've seen this everywhere.
Let's open the floor to questions. Can you introduce yourself and use a microphone, because this will be going on the recording? So let me introduce. This is Rick, my co-director, who I mentioned earlier.
Thank you very much. I think for all the book unveilings that we have done here, you've actually done perhaps the best job that I've seen of increasing interest in reading your book. So thank you very much. It's been great to listen to you, and I think you've got a red hot subject. Two questions. You started to talk about it here in terms of the aftermath, but in terms of the transparency of the state's preparation and the building of the coalition and of the communicating with the public once the event takes place, maybe you could describe which case has been most successful in your mind. And then we, since we've been working in Pakistan with you, Chris, over the last few years, we're also interested in whether there have been any good independent investigations or trusted commissions or anything that has helped to sort of bring the public along, assuming that in a democracy or even in any society they're going to be 10 or 20% who are always going to be somewhere outside of the mainstream. And as we know, even in this country, that exists. And so those would be my two questions. Have you seen any good independent investigations? Do you think it's a good medium? Do you think it's a way to maybe address something like the Red Mosque?
The Red Mosque is a complicated one. And there are other people in the room who may have different views than I do on this. We will never expect transparency on what happened at the Red Mosque. In my view, for the following reason, it was always an ISI asset. I mean, this idea that the Red Mosque just sort of blossomed on the scene as a troublesome locality is somewhat risible. And we know from the history of the place that it was always associated with sectarian violence. Mariam Abu Zahib, who just does fabulous work on sectarian militants and Jaish al-Mohammed, whenever she went to get Masood Azhar's most recent rant and raving, she would just saunter on over to the bazaar at the Red Mosque and request or purchase, if she had to, his DVDs. So I think there's, and this is just a known fact, I mean, the bazaar outside the Red Mosque was just crammed full of this stuff, and it had always been an asset for those groups. So I really, now the question is, of course, why did it go foul? I mean, and there's a number of answers. But given the history of the Red Mosque, I don't think we'll ever expect true transparency. It's just not in anyone's interest. Then the state would have to explain to its public why this was a militant redoubt for so long. So there are just so many questions. In the Pakistani establishment is not known for its transparency. Now, Shamin and I may have different views on which one was successful, but I think Operation Black Thunder, because it was the only one that actually took into account the information. They wouldn't call it an IO. I mean, retrospectively, they would put an IO label on it. But they were the only ones that really thought through the lessons of the previous operation, Operation Blue Star, and really sought to engage each and every single one of the failures of that first operation in their second operation.
I completely agree with Chris about Black Thunder. For all the cases that we read, this is clearly one case where the memories of Blue Star were so much alive and the costs would be so high that every possible error that had been that had taken place in Blue Star was sort of addressed in Black Thunder. It's fascinating that the government of India, which routinely produces white papers on all kinds of things, hasn't done this. I mean, the one way to address and to put to rest at least some of the myths and some of the embroidery that has taken place would be to produce a fairly extensive white paper. But they haven't done that. This is really quite curious, and that raises a very interesting question. The closest thing is that on the one of the two successful cases where a siege resulted in a nonviolent settlement was one of the two Kashmir cases. It involves the Hazrat Bal Shrine, which is of enormous significance throughout the entire valley, not only of religious significance to Kashmiri Muslims, because there is a profound belief that within the Hazrat Bal Shrine resides a hair of the Prophet Muhammad. And that sacred relic is of enormous significance to believers in the valley. When insurgents had taken refuge in the Hazrat Bal Mosque, initially the military's response was to conduct an operation which would send in commandos into the mosque. Fortunately, a senior civilian bureaucrat who was enormously knowledgeable about Kashmir and social mores and religious values and the like stepped up to the plate and said, no, let's not do that, because I think this is exactly the kind of thing that they want us to do, the insurgents, and with potentially disastrous consequences. Instead, let me take the role in negotiating with them. And this is to allude to something you just mentioned. He also sought the assistance of religious authorities. immediately and made that publicly known, thereby diffusing one potential point of conflagration. And then over the insistent, over the position of, he overruled, successfully managed to overrule the military, who wanted to deny food and water to the insurgents, for which he was routinely caricatured in the Indian press, saying that, yes, why don't we supply them with kebabs and with naan? He was the subject of the most vicious caricature, but it actually enabled him to build trust with the insurgents. Why do I mention this case at such length? For two reasons. One, it ended with a nonviolent resolution. Even though from the standpoint of the security forces, it was less than optimal because the insurgents were given safe passage. But if you think of the overall context, it was a small price to pay. Had any damage been done to the mosque, it would have made any conflagration in Kashmir between 1989 and the present day look like a tea party. And the second is, we have a fairly complete account written by him of this particular episode. And no one has challenged the veracity of any of the claims that he makes.
Okay, I'm getting a little mini list here. So, Shuja, do you want to go first and then Shannon?
Yeah, I'm wondering if you...
Can you introduce yourself,
please? Yeah, I'm Shuja Nawaz. I'm an independent analyst. I'm wondering if you went a little further back into history, particularly on the Kaaba and the attack on the Kaaba by the Allied forces in which they used Muslim soldiers, and whether this figured as one of the points that you explored, the use of troops or commanders of the same faith or the same ethnic group. Because if I recall, in Blue Star, it was General Brar who was a Sikh, and he was ostracized by members of his own community for that. The other point, whether you explore in connection with ceding the religious space to the insurgents, you explore the use of religious symbolism by the state. For instance, recently when I was in the Swat Malakand area, the general in charge of the operations in Pakistan in that area had named his operation Rah-e-Haq because he thought that it was silly to use a name like Operation Mountain Viper because that immediately cedes the Islamic ground to the insurgents. And I'm wondering if you picked this up also in your work. It'd be interesting to see if there are other similar instances.
Yes, in a way that is exactly the opposite of what you were arguing. For example, one of the most colossal and the most callous errors made in the Golden Temple episode, the first Golden Temple episode, namely Operation Blue Star, was conducted on a Sikh religious holiday. I mean, talk about cultural and religious insensitivity.
By a Sikh.
I mean, it's as if someone's brain was missing. I mean, how could you possibly do this? And no one has quite provided an answer to this question. So, yes, the manipulation of this kind of religious symbolism on the part of the state, or the lack of sensitivity on the part of the state, is of enormous significance. But at least I wasn't aware of the allied use of Muslim soldiers in the Kaaba. Perhaps you can elaborate.
Yeah, because I saw different versions of Pascal's chapter. There some reference to that was made in the chapter, perhaps in a footnote. But there are a couple of things about the Kaaba case. One, the Saudi state's first preference was that the National Guards were going to be able to take care of it, and they couldn't. I mean, as I mentioned, despite the fatwas, they had a number of defections. Because it was so humiliating for the regime to not be able to protect this most sacred shrine for Muslims, for lack of a better word, this is why it is completely shrouded in secrecy. I mean, they have done everything they can to not let any information leak, and it's an enormous problem for scholars to reconstruct it. But we do know, or what we think we know, because there have been some leaks about it, was that the French fellow that was finally brought in, of course, it was French, not Americans. And this was another element of I.O., because the militants said, oh, the Americans. And of course, we were considered to be far more dubious than the French. So there were rumors about the Americans were doing it, but it appears as if it was French commandos. They were all made to convert to Islam before they went in, because no non-Muslim, of course, could enter the Grand Mosque. So these issues, they come out in fragments, but because it was so humiliating to the Saudi regime, they've really taken enormous efforts to shroud this whole event in mystery. So what we can do is just, you know, pick the shards that have emerged.
Okay, first, the lady in the front row, please, and then Chen, and then you. Yeah, please go ahead, yeah.
Yes, Polly Nayak, an independent consultant. I actually wanted to go back to a subject that you're already launched on, which is how we can extrapolate further on the foreignness issue, where our counterinsurgency or counterterrorism operations are concerned, USG. And you talked a little bit about the option, I'm extrapolating, of at least using as your shock forces someone with local legitimacy, or conferring such legitimacy, as in the case you were just discussing. But I would actually like to push you both a little bit further on what other advice there might be for the U.S. government as a new administration comes in and looks at a set of operations it has committed to pushing forward, which very much involves sacred space, and where the U.S. has already made a lot of missteps in this area.
Patel.
It's interesting that you should ask this, Polly, because as luck would have it, all the PRT training for Afghanistan will be taking place at Indiana University in Bloomington. And so this is something that I'm actually integrally involved in, piecing together several faculty who are in religious studies, who are in the Department of Anthropology, and the like, language specialists. Not to be overly self-referential, but the university actually does have quite a record of area studies programs, much maligned in American political science, but now making a comeback. Several of the things that we are focusing on are sort of rudimentary knowledge of language. At least the most basic knowledge of language. Second, knowledge of local customs, mores, religious sentiments, values, and the like. Then some understanding of local politics, some understanding of local history. And all of this, by the way, is being packed into 2 weeks. This is like a crash course. I wouldn't want to be one of the students because, I mean, it is one of the most demanding programs that has been put together. But they do it with remarkably good cheer. So these are the kinds of things that I think are vital. And the fascinating thing here is we just finished a book in which Chris has a chapter on learning from India's experiences with counterinsurgency. You know, if I see one more book on the British experience in Malaya, I'm going to retch. For the very simple reason, this was a tiny operation. And it was an operation where you could target people fairly easily because they had psionic characteristics, for crying out loud. Okay? It wasn't that difficult. And no one talks about the British disaster in Kenya. There are two books out now on Kenya. One is called The Histories of the Hanged, and the other is called there's the word colonial, I'm forgetting. Imperial Imperial Reckoning, which shows that the British ran concentration camps in Kenya. And we somehow sort of elide over this and keep talking about Sir Gerald Templar and this extraordinary enterprise. Well, the fascinating thing is learning from the Indian experience is what the Indians have not learned about counterinsurgency and how they keep making the same errors over and over again. There is virtually no institutional memory in India. We walked into this project thinking that we would learn useful lessons which could be applied elsewhere. The biggest lesson that we've learned is that the Indians have botched it.
I have a couple of thoughts on that. The first thing that really strikes me is the value of recognizing early on when you're in a coin situation versus a counterterrorism situation. Yes. Because in a counterterrorism situation, it's about killing the bad guys. Yeah. In a coin situation, it's about securing the population in which the bad guys are ensconced. And so I think in many of the cases, all of the countries, and it's not just another person's terrorist, another person's insurgent. I mean, it's actually much more complicated than that. And I think we did this in Iraq. We did this in Afghanistan. The Indians have done it. They still debate whether the Punjab insurgency was an insurgency or was a purely a terrorist movement. But understanding what you're in is important because then it percolates down to the operators, what is my objective in this battle space? And the only one that really addresses your issue, the only chapter that we have is the Patel case. A couple of things there. He looked at two operations on Najaf, one which was under the initial coalition authority under Bremer, and then the transition after the Iraqi election. And it was under the auspices of the Iraqi elected government that operation seemed to be most successful. And he controls many of the structural factors, and he says that they were largely the same. What made the difference was, in fact, that you had a sovereign Iraqi government that had some credibility that could legitimize the operation. The other thing that really comes across all of the cases, and this is a truism, and it's nice that we're not finding anything totally different, is it's really police forces, not armies, that do this. That was, I think, in the Punjab case, what was critical was that they understood very quickly that the army had a supporting role. It can block up the border with Pakistan. It can do what armies do. But in the end, they had to plus up their police numbers. They had to plus up their training. They had to plus up their capabilities and their armaments. They also had to deal with police intelligence. And so I think all of the cases where there's been the best success is when there's been massive police involvement and that the police even if there are army elements used in the case of Black Thunder, that it has a police facade. And I think we're seeing this in Afghanistan. We're not going to win it. What's going to win it are going to be these Afghan forces one way or the other.
Right, and in Afghanistan, the police are woefully inadequate right now. We do forget that police have primacy in counterinsurgency, unfortunately, in too many places. Okay, Shannon, please, and then go to the back and then here.
I was just curious in your – yes, I'm Shannon Hayden with CSIS. I was just curious in your investigation of the Red Mosque incident if you came across any information about Chinese government involvement in pressuring the situation.
Yes. They don't mind if their engineers get beheaded in Gwadar, but let my madams free. No, I mean, the Chinese, they will tolerate this violence in the periphery, but – I think like many capitals, and this is why the insurgents did it, this is a challenge to the state authority. And if you're going to have a strategic relationship with this country, including missile and nuclear cooperation, you've got to have control over your capital. And I think this is it. Everyone who says the Chinese don't care about Pakistan's internal operations are crazy. The Chinese were very proactive. And right after Musharraf was given a dressing down by the Chinese, and within a couple of days, the National Security Council was convened, and boom, some tail was kicked.
Okay, please, can you come up?
Did you want to add to that?
No, that's quite adequate.
Can you just use the microphone? Thank you. See if we can do that without spilling coffee and stuff.
Colonel Datta, President of Indian Veteran Officers Association here, as well as from the Foreign Policy Association. There are a few things which I would like to correct, being very much in the thick of Operation Blue Star, and my unit was involved in it. First thing, that operation had to be undertaken, you strike when the iron is hot. Because the insurgents inside the Golden Temple had planned to capture the whole of Golden Temple within next 3 days. The operation was postponed, but under this intelligence, that operation had to be conducted. So, also with the consent of very senior Sikh generals, Lieutenant General Harbakh Singh, Lieutenant General T.S. Oberoi, those were a part of it, of decision-making body. Second, that the General Barar, who was the commander of this operation, was not taken or was what the word that was used was to be condemned by the Sikh Panth. No, he was taken back because he had done the right thing which the Sikh Panthic tenants demanded. Thirdly, the Operation Blue Star was an aftermath of Anandpur Sahib resolution, in which the insurgency was the aim, and also to provoke Indian Sikh units to revolt. And to that context, there was a help coming from across the border, in which PTV showed the Golden Temple crumbling down, that the Indian army had planned to destroy the temple. That's why Sikh center in Ranchi revolted en masse because of the very false propaganda. Now, the last fact that was the brigade was involved in this operation. There were two Sikh units who willingly participated in this, but wanted that they could go without the boots. They were allowed to. They suffered a lot of casualties because this was a sacred place to go with the boots in. So these are the observations which I would like to be corrected.
Well, I don't think anyone... First of all, they already had control of the Golden Temple, so I'm not sure I understand that. Two, their problems, it could have been preempted had they sort of understood what situation they were in. And we all know Bhindranwale was, in fact, a proxy gone awry. So, and what's interesting, the fact that you mentioned General Brar being taken back into the Panth, it was because he actually atoned. He had to go and do seva. He had to go and do service at the Golden Temple. He actually went to the Granthi. He asked, what can I do to atone for what I've done? Atoning implies a recognition that something was not right in the first place. And he was told that he had to do shoe duty at the Juthakhana. He had to do seva to help clean up the Golden Temple. So I think actually the personal experience of General Brar is actually very interesting because it does demonstrate that some reflection about the consequences of what he did and his position within his Sikh community. I think you actually make our point even stronger that that was a terribly fraught operation. And also, I might add, what's interesting about that was how poorly the intelligence was done. The militants had actually, not only had they taken control of the Golden Temple, but they'd also taken control of the bazaar in which the Golden Temple was ensconced. So they had taken over the sarais, they'd taken over the water towers, they were using them as sniper positions. The various Indian paramilitary and police organizations completely and abjectly failed to deprive the militants access of not only the temple itself, but even this expanded area, which eventually became no-go zones for the Indian security forces.
Yeah. Okay, please. Maybe you can use this one right here.
I'm Kevin Gates. I'm with the House Armed Services Committee. I was hoping to sort of riff on one of the earlier questions about lessons learned for U.S. government forces. You talked about the training for the PRTs, but I'm interested to see if you have any lessons that would be applied to the general purpose forces, because I think in a lot of cases it's not the special operations forces are better trained and culturally aware in a lot of these instances, but it's the general purpose forces that are not attuned to these situations that are often the ones that are put into a situation where they're required to do some sort of action. So I'm wondering if you have any lessons that might be applied to that, because we've been particularly interested on the committee in terms of how to or what level of cultural awareness needs to be instilled in the general purpose forces, and in particular in the operational planning. And I'm also interested if you've had an opportunity to sort of socialize this with folks in the military, because we're sort of at a point now where there's a lot of doctrinal churn, and there seems to be receptivity between the new COIN manual and new stability ops manual to get this sort of thing into the doctrine.
Two responses. Not just from this book alone, but also from this other study that we've just completed on counterinsurgency operations, the history of counterinsurgency operations in India. Two things become very, very clear. One is that the Indian experience with counterinsurgency is hardly an unmitigated disaster. Some things have worked, particularly in the Indian Northeast, where you have former insurgents now as now in political authority, in legitimate political authority. But the fascinating thing is the very military units that participated in those operations never transmitted what they learned onto the next set of operations. Somehow or other, there's a hiatus, and we haven't been able to quite fathom why this hiatus exists between the clearly successful operations conducted over time after various mistakes were made, course corrections made, and then a successful end to the insurgency. But somehow or other, that's not passed on. So the one of the first things is to somehow have a kind of an institutional memory that is sort of distilled and passed on. And just in passing, I'll mention that there is a striking similarity between the Indian counterinsurgency manual and the recent counterinsurgency manual that's been published. Ours, of course, is much more elaborate, goes into much greater depth, whereas many of the points in the Indian counterinsurgency manual are fairly tacit. But the overall message is markedly similar. But to answer your question more directly, what the Indian military has done after a series of errors is now in Kashmir to create a counterinsurgency school, which is a mock-up of a Kashmiri village. And any unit, and these are not special operations units, these are not, there is a particular set of regiments in the Indian Army that are designed for counterinsurgency operations, which have a very low teeth-to-tail ratio, so that they can be mobilized quickly and inserted quickly. But without even relying on those particular units, when even regular units are inducted into Kashmir, they go for like a six-week training period through this village, where they are acclimatized to the expectations of life in Kashmir, thereby giving them a certain kind of training, imparting a certain kind of training, so that they would not make the routine errors that regular conventional forces are prone to making. So this is perhaps one very important lesson that can be gleaned from the Indian counterinsurgency experience. Very belated, but better late than never.
I have just two brief additional things. The Army always changes its terminology, so I may be using terminology that dates me. But a number of years ago when I was at RAND, we have a unit that works on operations on urbanized terrain. And did a lot of work looking at intelligence preparation of the battlefield. And it seems to me that these kinds of elements should be integrated into IPB or whatever it has been rechristened. And I think this kind of battle space is not going to go away, in part because many of the insurgent movements that countries are facing tend to be religious. And they actually represent a sort of a dual puzzle that we lay out in the introduction of the book. Because of urbanization, many of these shrines are also in urban space. So it's a double whammy that You're already operating in an environment where most conventional militaries still don't do urban operations all that terribly well, despite all the money that's been spent working on doctrine and training. But then on top of the challenges of urban terrain, you've got sacred terrain. And so this, I think, maybe the kinds of resources that have been spent to think about urban ops should really be spent on this issue.
Great, great question. Okay, sorry, did you have a question? You, yeah, I think you were first, and then Rob, you and Rob, okay.
All right. Christopher Mitchell, George Mason University. British by birth, and reminded by a comment that you made that, of course, it was the British that invented concentration camps.
I didn't say they invented. I said they utilized concentration camps.
Well, they invented them.
Oh, okay.
The Boer War, 1900. I have a paradox listening to you, and I'd like to ask you whether you think that it's the extent to which the way sacred spaces present barriers to counterinsurgency depends upon the nature and extent of the sacredness, whatever that is, and some of the religions from which they spring, because the situation that I know a little bit about. Sacredness seems to be absolutely no barrier to security forces. This is sort of Colombia. You know, churches, whatever. The security forces will go in, and if they don't go in themselves, they'll whistle up their paramilitary allies and send them in. And, of course, you know, Colombia is an almost totally Catholic country, so you know, you're almost back to the situation in Guatemala in the 1980s where the slogan was, you know, be a patriot, kill a priest. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's the connection between the nature of the religious beliefs mm-hmm. and the extent to which sacredness does actually provide some kind of a barrier to soldiers and police going in? Sorry, it's a very academic question, but
excellent question. But I think the first thing is that all of our insurgencies that we look at in this book are actually religious-based insurgencies. So the sacred space is the terrain over which. Now, I don't know the Columbia case, but I don't believe they call them. They even take that mantle. So I think that's huge. And actually, Ron Hasner does a fantastic. Running across Ron was great, because just as Shumit and I were talking about this topic, Ron wrote a fantastic piece in the Washington Quarterly looking at military operations on sacred space, and we knew right away we had to get Ron roped in. So Ron actually did a really nice job laying out a sort of a topography of what kind of spaces are more sacred than others, so that operational planners can actually think through that. Because sometimes you have the situation where, in point of fact, it's just a middling space. But the insurgents may have such information dominance that they can make it into a much better, a much more sacred space than it was. It's like that Monty Python. With a little bit of money, it could be much more sacred. So this is something that the counterinsurgents really have to be on top of, is, you know, how do you manage the sort of ex post facto making of this into a more sacred space? But Ron Hasner, I think, does a great job of this.
The one response that I have, and I can't remember, but it's a Central American country where military forces actually killed an archbishop, El Salvador. There, actually, it had rather deleterious consequences. So, but the central point, I think, is the one that Chris made, that every one of the cases that we study, religion, politics, and insurgency were closely intermingled. It may be what we have is a fallacy of composition here, if one wants to use an academic term, in that we choose a particular universe of cases, but we are fairly self-conscious about it, in that we make no bones about it, that we are looking at a particular subset of insurgencies.
Can I just have a quick follow-on? Is that why you didn't choose Israel-Palestine conflict?
Well, we have the Church of the Nativity, because that was a really good example. Now, that's actually an anomalous case, because, A, you had insurgents who took sanctuary in a church, not of their confessional orientation. And then you had the Israelis, who also probably, I don't want to speak to every Israeli that was involved, probably they weren't Christian. And then you actually had the Pope intervening. And that was another example of a situation that was resolved. I mean, the Israelis understood that if they savaged the Church of Nativity, this would be an enormous PR problem for them. The insurgents, I think, understood the same because obviously Christianity is also an important part of Palestinian culture. That, you know, even though many of the militants were obviously Muslim, the community on whose behalf they're fighting are not all Muslim. So that was a really interesting case that we didn't treat it as its own chapter because it was so bizarre. But actually, many of the lessons that came out of that were really quite simple. It was about audience costs. It was about securing the community in which, you know, fighting over the community that the militants were trying to engage.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, please, you and then Rob.
Yes. Right. Ira Hauck, Army Chaplain with George Mason University, Conflict Analysis and Resolution. A lot of discussion is centered around the religious entrepreneurship. As a religious analyzer in military operations, we are also concerned about how we encounter an entire religious system. Is there other thoughts when you discuss the topic of the role of religion in conflict situations? Are there other ways to engage a religion in a conflict situation besides the identified religious entrepreneur or religious leader?
So the Sikh diaspora is an interesting one. So, you know, the Indian government actually spent a lot of time and effort reaching out to the diaspora because you actually had gurdwaras here in the States, the UK, and Canada that actually lined up for or against the insurgency. And so that was a really, you know, really interesting case of going after their international supporters, trying to get gurdwaras here to not align with the militant message. And I thought that was actually sort of interesting. After Blue Star, what was fairly a niche, not terribly popular, highly caste-ridden insurgency became a global phenomenon where Sikhs all over the world began being involved. So that's an interesting case where those individuals themselves are not at the ground zero of the conflict, but they were actually very important in either undermining or galvanizing support internationally. They also, you know, one other interesting point on that, some of this, because I did my dissertation on the Sikh diaspora, so I spent some time looking at how folks position themselves. They also became important interlocutors here to press our Congress for action. So, you know, when you think, sometimes it's easy to think about diasporas as being irrelevant, but much of the early congressional activity was pioneered by these pro-insurgency groups.
Including an obscure congressman who will go unnamed from Indiana, who probably could not have placed Punjab on a map.
Right. Okay, Rob.
Lieutenant Colonel Robert Scott, Marine Fellow here at CSIS. And what I wanted to do was follow up and give up some things to think about on your comment, because I think the military organizations, the services for some of our failures, we are learning organizations, and we do try to incorporate primarily learning from our failures, more from our successes. We still call it IPB. There's been a lot of debate on how you incorporate the cultural piece into IPB and how you get individuals to pay attention to that. And more importantly, who guides you through identifying who those IO brokers and religious players are. On the Marine side, I would say that there's been a lot of work of taking conventional forces and getting them prepared to do the counterinsurgency mission in theater. For example, the Marine Corps has taken a village or created a village, hired Iraqi Americans out of 29 Palms. It's called Mojave Viper. Every unit that goes into theater in Iraq must graduate from Mojave Viper, and it takes it from the tactical level to the operational level. So the regiment and battalion, they're getting a workout. Can they do IPB? Can they plan the operation? Can they take this plan, transmit it, and then can that Marine and corpsman execute the mission on the ground? Now what we're trying to do is figure out how do we transition that for Afghanistan so that we don't spend 3 years trying to figure out to build a Mojave Viper in order to get a unit ready to go. So I think there's been a lot of work done. It's a function of figuring out where that belly button is and pushing it to get your information. I think the book's probably about 90% there. And then the last part I would close with is I think you have to be careful, and I would caution or give a caveat of saying it's an either-or. Because the bulk of this, of the fight, is going to be done by a police force if it's in a nation like Colombia, where the military does have a very strong police function and not necessarily a thing. It is a good discussion, but you're like in Afghanistan where we're trying to build an Afghan national police as well as an Afghan national army. Debate as to which one's more successful. But the Small Wars Manual, written in 1921 by the Marine Corps, does lay out a lot of it. And when I was in Afghanistan for 8 months as a battalion XO, the Small Wars Manual was on my desk. And we referred to it as we went into the NAPC election in 2005 in September. So there's a tremendous amount of lessons learned out there that we've tried to incorporate. And I just wanted to follow up on that because I think that at least the takeaway for me is that maybe we weren't answering your question is what, or your question is what do we do for lessons learned? And I think Admiral Mullen, as he's moved out as a chairman and asking for a review of strategy, I don't think he's really asking for a review of strategy as much as a review of development of grand strategy at the national level, where there we can task out and we can execute a mission with the elements of national power out there. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I think we have time for one final question. Is there anybody who hasn't spoken yet who wants to jump in before?
Okay.
Yeah, please. Can you introduce yourself? Thank you, Marvin.
Marvin Weinbaum, Middle East Institute. You know, what we're hearing then is you really did take a subset because sacred space obviously is a broader definition than where we started out. The kicking down the door and going into the women's quarters is entering sacred space. And so I think many of the comments here from military types in particular have now alerted us to the fact that we have to define this in a broader way, and that the most obvious is where we actually have an institution. But that sacred space is something that we have to become much more cognizant of in a broader way.
Great.
I don't know if I agree with that. I almost always agree with you. So this is a first. As Ron Hasner lays out, we're talking about a particular puzzle, not culturally important or culturally valued, or that's a totally different phenomenon. We're really talking about religious symbols. We're talking about the sacred terrain. Like, let's take one of my favorite examples is religious terrorism. In some ways, religious terrorism offers the terrorist or the insurgent benefits that no secular cause can offer, because they're offering divine benefits, and those benefits will always be greater than any sort of temporal punishment that could be levied upon that individual. So in other words, the realm of the sacred, really, I hate using jargon, but I think this is maybe the best way of saying it, it opens up different opportunity structures for the militant groups in question. Now, this is not to say that what you mentioned is not important, but we really are looking at the realm of the religious as used by religious-based insurgencies. And I don't think there's any reason to believe that this thing is going to go away. I mean, if we look at the Pew data, what we see is that many countries, their populations are becoming more, not less, religiously radicalized. So I think some of the issues that we draw out in this book are not going to go away, regrettably, anytime soon.
I think what Marvin was referring to is, you know, that's really much more a matter of cultural sensitivity.
Yeah.
And it does not implicate the same kinds of issues that a religious-based insurgency involves. And particularly ones where sacred places become implicated because of the, as Ron Hasner very correctly points out, that sacred places are fraught with a significance that other places simply are not.
And consequently, it's a different order of battle that you're faced with here.
I mean, like, take, for example, a school. You could go in and you could mow down every single female student in a regular school, and students across the world are not going to unite in opposition to this horrific event. But you go into the girls' madrasa associated with the Lao Masjid, and that actually has the capacity to galvanize a much wider insurgency, because it's not the fact that it's a school. It's the fact that it's a sacred location and that the girls there were engaging in a sacred activity. Is that...
The only reason I brought it up is that when we talk about lessons learned, yeah, the application here is so much more. There are just so many of these incidents, whereas what I think others were getting into here, were driving us in that direction, was that they were looking for ways in which some of what you've learned here could have applicability in a cultural setting.
Absolutely.
Just a final, very quick
observation. Stanley Kovar with the Cato Institute. It seems to me we're looking at it from the counterinsurgency, but why would the insurgents go into their own sacred spaces? And the point is they're saying, we want to win. We have heard a lot recently about there are no military solutions to this problem, only political solution. If they're going into their own sacred spaces, what they are saying, we're not interested in a political solution. We want to win. We want to escalate. This is total.
I'm not sure that's true.
I think certainly the Kashmir and the Punjab cases.
They go there because it offers advantages that increase the likelihood of their winning because it's going to goad the state into doing something that has catastrophic
consequences.
Yeah, so in almost all cases, it ensures their victory. But in the case of Habibullah, I mean, there was a space for negotiation. They won that battle, but they didn't win that war.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's leave that final point maybe to ponder over. Just to reiterate again, very grateful for the opportunity to host this. Chris has often done very innovative books. Her last book was a cookbook from Conflict Zones. So, I watch this space and see what she comes up with next. But you certainly should be buying this book. I'm sorry we didn't have any here today. We hope to, but for some reason, I don't think the press probably thought they would sell thousands, so maybe they backed out. Tomorrow morning at 9, we're hosting an event on the ISI in Pakistan for those of you who want to join us. It's at 9 o'clock because we'll be bringing in two Pakistanis and someone from Harvard University. So look forward to seeing some of you then, and thank you again.